You know, I don't think any moment's too big for him. I think he's just going to go about his normal weekly rhythm this week. Certainly, we don't shy away from, you know, what is at stake in terms of what we can accomplish, but we also know what a great challenge it is. But I just think that, you know, like you've heard us say over and over, Gary, he really doesn't allow himself to get too high, too low. I don't ever really feel like any moment's too big for him, and that's why you feel confident that you know it's a great challenge, but you do feel confident in his ability to perform and lead our offense at a high level on Sunday.
That was Sean McVay on Jared Goff. If the Rams win the Super Bowl, people will view Sean McVay as the next Don Shula. That is my take.
Why Don Shula?
Why Don Shula?
I don't know. I was just thinking of guys who had a high degree of success as a younger in age head coach at the NFL or just professional level.
Yeah, but Don Shula had already, like, he'd been a really good football player, too. I was curious why you chose Don Shula.
We can choose somebody else.
Early success?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Early success.
Was Shula dating a supermodel? Was Shula a particularly handsome man?
Shula was, I know that Shula, I remember reading Art Donovan's book, because Art Donovan was a great defensive lineman from the early Colts. I think they won, like, before the Super Bowl, they won championships too, right? Like, he was there with, like, through the whole time. And I remember him talking about how, you know, Don Shula talked a big game about how, you know, he was a taskmaster and a disciplinarian, but when he was a player, he was kind of a wild man.
Yeah.
So Don Shula might have been like Sean McVay, except back then it wasn't, you know, there was...
As publicized?
TMZ was much less active in Don Shula's day. There was very, very little TMZ coverage. They were just a small little tabloid.
I mean, I guess we could go with another young NFL coach who has won that big. But I don't think there have been that many that I can think of, at least in recent memory.
What about John Gruden?
Jeff Fisher was young. He didn't win a Super Bowl.
Yeah, Mike Tomlin, I guess, was fairly young. But I don't know that people thought about Mike Tomlin the same way they're talking right now about Sean McVay.
I wonder why that is. He was a really young coach that came in and had immediate success, but he was doing it with a franchise that was already had won a Super Bowl in the not too past.
I think it's nothing as Tomlin. It's more just
and what you're implying, maybe.
I think it's more just the Steelers and, like, no offense to McVay.
Sean McVay took a forlorn franchise and turned it around.
Yeah, and
Mike Tomlin stepped into a situation where they'd gotten a little bit stale after just winning a Super Bowl, and I don't know if a turnaround's quite the same.
And Tomlin did not have the same, like, revolutionary effect on defense, his specialty side of the ball, as McVay seems to be having on the offensive side of the ball.
Yeah.
So again, here is your lesson on a Football Friday. If the Rams win the Super Bowl in 2.5 weeks, people will view Sean McVay as the next Don Shula. Think on that for the next couple days. At least the next 48 hours. Next Don Shula.
So all of you kids out there, and you remember what it was like watching Don Shula coach.
Go look up Don Shula's coaching career. It's unbelievable. He coached
really
for like 30 years.
Don Shula and Dan Marino. A lot of you kids out there will think, hey, Dan Marino, who's that? Some clown that never won a Super Bowl. No.
It's true.
This is a man that moved leather gloves in a time when leather gloves were falling out of fashion. Sexy Dan Marino. Man that kept his job on television long after he should have, just because he was sexy Dan Marino.
Yes.
You guys don't even know.
He was in Ace Ventura.
You don't know what it was like trying to even get a hit on Dan Marino, because he got rid of the ball so fast. It was the most frustrating thing in the world.
Did you make Dan Marino retire? Were you on that Jaguars team?
I was on that team, yeah. 62-7. What was the final score of that game?
A million to zero, yes.
Yeah, Jimmy Johnson benched Dan Marino. And people criticize Jimmy Johnson for that, but that was an act of mercy.
Yeah.
That was an old Yeller moment right there. That Dan Marino was throwing up ducks that didn't even look like... That was an insult to ducks to call those things ducks.
For those who want a comparison to Dan Marino, especially at the late stages of his career, look no further than Philip Rivers throwing temper tantrums on the field, because that was what Dan Marino was in my lifetime.
Listen.
Watching him from 1995 through 1999, and then my mom coming in, or was it 99, I think, was when you guys killed him the way that you did, Seth. And I remember my mom would come in as we were watching Dan Marino cuss and yell at everyone on TV, and she's like, I don't like that man.
I don't remember that side of him. I guess it was just, maybe it was more common back then. It wasn't such a big deal when a quarterback threw a tantrum at somebody.
I think that might have been when they first started to have those ISO cameras on guys in between plays. And Dan Marino, I remember vividly in Patriot-Dolphin games, even when the Dolphins were winning, Dan Marino was always cussing up a storm. And my mom said, I don't like him.
It was like Peyton talking to his guys out on the field. It's just, frankly, I was aghast. I almost went Southern Belle at times. Peyton, you should not talk to another grown man in that fashion.
I cannot believe this.
There is a fashion trend that is sweeping across the National Football League.
Isotoner gloves?
Yes, leather gloves are back, but also clock management and challenge assistance, because Atlanta, they hired one for Dan Quinn. The Panthers, they want to get one for Ron Rivera. And apparently the Steelers are looking at a way to give Mike Tomlin one of those guys. Said Art Rooney the second, quote, "I agree that having someone with that responsibility is important. Mike and I have talked about that. I'm not sure that's the only thing that person needs to do. It'd have to be somebody who's on staff that has a role to fill there," which is an interesting way. I think you would want someone who is very good at maybe scheduling things, managing things in the moment. I'm not 100% sure that a football coach is necessarily going to be the best person for that kind of
scheduling
job.
Scheduling things like, you mean just as
I just mean
the...
being aware of the clock. I feel like you want someone that has in some way, shape, or form been operating with the clock in mind. Maybe you want a former quarterback or something to be thinking about the clock, thinking about what the quarterback might be thinking going up to the line of scrimmage before a play.
This is where, because remember, Jim Bernhardt used to be Bill O'Brien's right-hand man. He retired last year. And I wonder, I don't know exactly how that role was filled, but it was presumably Jim Bernhardt who might have been doing a lot of that stuff for Bill O'Brien during the game. This is where it's difficult. And this is where I think O'Brien has a, he has a framework in place for how to get all these things done, you know, and they do kind of play calling by committee the way a lot of teams do play calling by committee. They might have one coach that was responsible for red zone run plays. And you remember that one, we saw mic'd up with Bill O'Brien where he was saying into the mic, "I need to get the ball to so-and-so," or "we need to get DeAndre, give me a play to get DeAndre the ball." So that's a little bit of how it works. But the difficult part of a head coach also being the offensive coordinator is that in these critical moments where you're trying to decide whether you should go for it on fourth down, as a head coach, maybe your offensive coordinator is working on finding the perfect play.
Yeah.
So there are, or is it maybe if the head coach, if you have an offensive coordinator and a head coach, the head coach is deciding whether to challenge something, getting all that input. Well, the offensive coordinator is figuring out what's the next play going to be, what personnel is the defense in. Yep. There's a certain degree of multitasking that goes on there that I think like one human being can't do.
I agree.
So it's a matter of having, at the very least, if you are the head coach and offensive coordinator, you've got to have somebody you really trust that can grab you. And hopefully it's not Shane Leckler, the punter, telling you to challenge the play like we saw 2 years ago.
Yes.
Remember when there was an egregious challenge that needed to be challenged, and Shane Leckler had to grab Bill O'Brien and tell him to do it?
I think it was in the playoffs, if I recall correctly, which is terrifying. Would we agree or disagree with the idea? I think this has gotten a little bit better in the last year or two. I think they've gotten a little...
Game management...
Yeah.
Decisions and or indecisions.
Challenges,
remember,
clock management.
Yeah, I don't remember being as... This season.
This season he was better.
So, I think they've been better at this.
Now, this is interesting, and our friend Darren McKee first noticed this. Nobody else had ever told this to me. I always assumed that the coaches up in the box had something more advanced than the television copy to look at. They do not.
They don't.
They don't have DVR. They don't have anything. So when you've got a crap CBS broadcasting the game, and they don't give you a replay until like the opposing team is back up at the line ready to call the play, it makes it a lot dicier. So like we at home actually have a better ability to go back and watch some of the replays before the broadcast gets to it than the coaches in the box do.
That's why we saw Savage shaking with whatever ailment he had last year, and I guess nobody on the sideline did.
Well, I went back and did the real-time analysis of that. Everybody acted like they'd been showing that replay nonstop, where really it was like 3 seconds of airtime in the following 10 minutes.
It took some
time. They showed it for 3 seconds, and like nobody's watching at that point. They're calling a football game, and that was it. But then afterwards, when everybody's seeing it on Twitter and everything, they acted like it had been up on the big board the entire time.
Right, and I don't know how anyone would have been able to see that from the field when you're not allowed to step outside of the 30-yard line. You have to stay in between the 30-yard line on the sideline and then see through a bunch of offensive linemen that would have been blocking the view of Tom Savage because they're all in front of him and O'Brien's line of sight. Also, as we have noticed over the last year, Bill Bill O'Brien now wears glasses.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I think that's helped.
No, those aren't reading glasses. Those are concussion spotting glasses. The biggest thing about the Tom Savage, I don't know how we ended back up here revisiting the Tom Savage scenario. The biggest thing on that one was the spotters. Like, the NFL spotters who are supposed to just be watching for things like this saw a classic case, that fencing position where your arms are, what's it called? Isotonic posturing. I've become a traumatic brain injury specialist now. It's like a clear-cut indication of a brain injury. It was right out there for that to see. You've got four people in the stadium that are supposed to be watching for this stuff, and none of them noticed it. It was insane.
I don't mind the idea of the Texans naming somebody as some clock management expert or guru, but I've always been kind of skeptical of this whole thing, because ultimately, the head coach of an NFL team is kind of like the president. The buck stops with him. So mm-hmm. You can have whatever guy you want. Ultimately, it's not on Kyle Shanahan for what happened in the Super Bowl. It's on Dan Quinn,
right?
Because he's the head coach. And
don't even get me started on that.
Yeah, Herm Edwards. 5 minutes? Herm Edwards. I looked this up last night. He installed one of these guys in like 2004, and Herm was notably terrible at this sort of thing. And I have always felt, watching football games, that you have to have a sense for clock management, like a sense for sports. Well, and I think a lot
play more Madden, maybe.
Yeah, like when you watch a lot of football games, you get into this rhythm and routine of like how things should be. And I don't know how to sit there and explain to somebody, because that's their area of expertise, coaching a football game, how clock management should work. Because it's not just the math. There's also a feel portion to it.
Well, there's a feel portion to it, but there is also the math of just simply understanding that, like, when you're trying to run the clock out, first downs are more important than scoring.
Yes.
And just things like this, that a play is worth 6 seconds, and you've got to figure out a way to get as many of those 6 seconds stacked up. Likewise with your timeouts. Like, a timeout now is better than a timeout later, all that. So there's that side of it. But then, also, the play calling by committee, I'm always intrigued by this, and I know every team does it a different way. But when you are, there's something to be said for just getting into a rhythm and understanding something, you know, and like having a play caller that doesn't have to be worried about all this other stuff. That's the beauty of an offensive coordinator. And that's why I guess it's becoming in vogue. Are there more head coaches who are play callers now than there were 10 years ago? I think so, because there used to only be a handful.
Yeah.
You know, Sean Payton, even though he wasn't actually the offensive coordinator, there were very few.